counsel in the second case may come forward and get ready. All right, if counsel are ready, I will call the second case on today's oral argument calendar. That is case number A23-709, Omar Quabena Walford versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, I believe that both of you are familiar with our typical procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you may approach. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Michael McLaughlin, and I'm an attorney from the State Public Defender's Office, and I'm representing Omar Walford on this appeal. This appeal presents two principal issues. The first is whether Mr. Walford's plea was unintelligent because he was misadvised about his right to appeal. And the second issue is whether his plea was invalid because the procedures used to find him competent violated due process and Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 2001. This argument will not focus on the ineffective assistance claim, although I'll answer any questions that the court has about that issue. For a plea to be intelligent, a defendant must be advised of the consequences of the guilty plea. And if a defendant is misadvised about those consequences, the plea is unintelligent. In Minnesota, a defendant has a general right to appeal from a conviction, but if a defendant enters a guilty plea, the guilty plea causes the defendant to waive the right to appeal non-jurisdictional pretrial issues. The record shows that at the plea proceeding, Mr. Walford was misadvised that he would have the right to appeal pretrial discovery and speedy trial issues after his guilty pleas. Based on this erroneous information, his plea was invalid and unintelligent.
Counsel, can you address the appropriate standard of review? I think you argue that the standard of review is de novo, and respondent argues that we should apply plain error.
Yes. So Mr. Walford's claim is that the plea was unintelligent and invalid. This court reviews the intelligence of a plea de novo under State versus Tice, State versus Ecker. That's established that that's the standard of review on intelligence of plea claims. The state's taken the position that plain error should apply and has principally relied on the State versus Myrie case to support that proposition. The key difference between this case and Myrie is in Myrie, the appellant was asserting error under Rule 2601. And then the Supreme Court determined that plain error could be applied to that assertion of error by the appellant. Here, Mr. Walford has never made a claim that the proceedings violated 2601. His argument has always been that the plea was invalid because it was unintelligent. So the plain error analysis of Myrie is really an opposite to the arguments that Mr. Walford makes here.
So if we apply a de novo standard of review to this issue, does the fact that appellant didn't file an appeal of the speedy trial and discovery issues that he had a misunderstanding about, does that affect our analysis as to the intelligence of the plea in any way? I mean, you know, the state makes an argument about that, but that's as part of the plain error analysis. So I'm wondering, in de novo review, is that relevant at all?
It wouldn't be relevant to de novo review of the intelligence of the plea. In our view, the intelligence of the plea is determined by what the defendant knew at the time of the plea. So whether he subsequently filed a notice of appeal or not, the judgment of whether he was misadvised about his right to appeal is determined by the plea record. Whether or not he pursued the direct appeal isn't relevant to the intelligence of the plea. Regarding the plain error analysis, the state takes the position that, so the state essentially concedes the first two prongs of plain error and then argues that Mr. Walford's rights, that the error did not substantially, or did not affect Mr. Walford's substantial rights because he still retained the right to appeal even after his guilty plea. And we challenge that that argument that the state makes, that you know if this court chooses to review this claim under plain error, it should conclude that Mr. Walford was prejudiced by whatever occurred in district court. While this court has occasionally reached pretrial issues, even after a defendant enters what looks like a guilty plea, this court is, and the Minnesota Supreme Court has never held that a defendant has the right to appeal following pretrial issues following a guilty plea. Instead, this court's replea said that the defendant loses the right to appeal non-jurisdictional pretrial issues after a guilty plea. And although this court has occasionally exercised discretion to, you know, to show leniency and reach those pretrial issues, that's something different than having the right to appeal. A right is a legal entitlement. And Mr. Walford lost any legal entitlement to appeal by pleading guilty. So he was prejudiced by the erroneous advice that he would have the right to appeal his pretrial issues.
But we don't know for sure, right? I mean, it seems like maybe, I mean, who knows? If he had filed a notice of appeal, maybe this court or the Supreme Court would have characterize the district court record in one way or the other in order to allow him to go forward. It strikes me almost like a exhaustion issue, or he didn't exhaust his appellate rights. He didn't even try.
And exhaustion analysis has never been applied to the validity of a guilty plea. It's never been applied to determine whether there was reversible plain error. Our point would be that while it is possible that this court would have reached the pretrial issues, that possibility is something different than a right. It's something different than a legal entitlement. And he lost that legal entitlement despite being told at the time of his plea that he would retain that legal entitlement. And also, this case looks very different from the cases in which this court has reached pretrial issues. You know, in Lothenbach, in Ford, in Faber, and in Myrie, there was an articulation on the record that the parties wanted to do a Lothenbach or wanted to proceed with a stipulated evidence trial or wanted to do something to preserve the right of appeal. Here, there was no reference to Rule 2601. There's no reference to a stipulated evidence, trial by stipulated evidence. And the only reference to Lothenbach was advisory counsel repeatedly telling Mr. Walford that this was not a Lothenbach and that his case was not eligible for a Lothenbach. So there's nothing in this record that would have led this court to conclude that this was a functional equivalent to a Rule 2601 proceeding and that would have led this court to review the pretrial issues. So, I mean, while it's possible this court would have exercised that discretion, the state would have had a compelling argument that the court should not reach those pretrial issues. And I think it's also notable that the way the state is using all that case law here is really the opposite of the spirit of those cases. Those cases were about expanding a defendant's right to review and ensuring that a defendant didn't unknowingly lose the right to appeal and reaching appellate issues, broadening the scope of this appellate review, this court's appellate review. Here the state uses that same case law to try to restrict the scope of appellate review and to apply a more demanding standard to Mr. Walford's claims. So it's not supported. The state's contention isn't supported because even if this court could have reached it, it still doesn't mean he had the right to appeal. And then also the state's position really, you know, uses cases that were intended to be a shield to defendants as a sword to try to cut down Mr. Walford's right of appellate review. So we'd ask the court to reject that whole line of argument and just to apply de novo review to this claim. A case also, it's an unpublished case, but it is on point with this case in a lot of ways that, that we'd ask the court to look at is, this court's case in State versus Herring. I just couldn't remember the name. Herring similarly was a guilty plea case where the defendant was told before the guilty plea that that he could appeal pretrial issues. Defendant brought a post-conviction. Post-conviction court concluded that because the defendant still could have raised those issues on appeal despite his guilty plea, that the guilty plea was intelligent. And this court rejected that reasoning and held essentially that the guilty plea caused the defendant to lose the right to appeal. He was told he could appeal, and that made the plea unintelligent, and that a post-conviction court can't make a non-appealable issue appealable just by saying that the defendant could have appealed it, that that's instead based on the way that this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court has defined the scope of appellate review following a guilty plea. So I'd ask this court just to look at the persuasive reasoning of State versus Herring as well on this issue.
I see, in addition to Herring, I see Fondren and Avila on pages 20 and 21 of your brief, all three non-precedential opinions. I'm curious whether, about the procedural posture of those cases, were they like this case where the defendant appellant did not file a notice of appeal and then later sought to invalidate the plea, or are they cases in which the defendant appellant filed a notice of appeal directly from the conviction and then these dispositions occurred?
Herring was a stayed direct appeal. Then the defendant filed a post-conviction filing notice of appeal and then staying the direct appeal.
Both ways.
Fondren, I believe, reached the court by direct appeal, but I'm not positive on that. But I think the principles of those cases are still the same, that these cases have held that if a defendant's told that he can appeal pretrial issues before a guilty plea, and the defendant relies on that information and enters a guilty plea, that's sufficient to render a plea unintelligent. And in none of those cases looked at this through the scope of a plain error analysis, as the state said, it's just looked at it as whether or not the plea was intelligent. So we'd ask this court to approach the case in the same way.
It seems to me that whether the plain error rule applies depends upon whether Myrie applies. I mean, would you agree with that?
Well, yes, and I think whether Myrie applies depends on the type of error that's asserted by the defendant. So, I mean, if Mr. Walford would have asserted that the error here was the court didn't follow Rule 2601, then we would be in a Myrie category where this court would look at that plain error. But Mr. Walford doesn't make that claim. He makes a claim that his plea was unintelligent. So that's the reason why Myrie doesn't apply and why de novo should apply.
You don't disagree with my point that whether Myrie applies is kind of, then that directs us to plain error or not.
Yep, well, I agree. Yep. If this court found Myrie applied, I mean, Myrie did state for a Rule 2601 error that's not preserved below, that plain error should be applied to that. So we'd agree if this was a 2601 error case, Myrie would apply.
But Myrie didn't involve a challenge to the constitutionality of the plea.
No.
Correct.
No. And then the on the second issue, the competency issue, Mr. Walford makes three principal claims for why the competency procedures here violated Rule 21 and due process. And what happened was, in two instances, a district court suspended proceedings based on reason to doubt Mr. Walford's competency, and twice ordered competency evaluations. At this time, Mr. Walford was pro se, and the record shows, and the state doesn't dispute, that he was not served with either competency report. The state's taken the position that a pro se defendant has no right to notice of a competency report, that the service only must be given on, a licensed attorney who is acting as counsel and not a defendant who is acting as his own counsel. We reject that interpretation of Rule 21. Rule 21 refers to counsel. One defendant is pro se. He is his own counsel, his own attorney. So a pro se defendant falls under the plain language of Rule 201. And the state's reading of the rule, and the state's taken even the position that a pro se defendant isn't even entitled to receive. So it's not just that he's not required to be served with it, that he's not even in, that he has no right to receive it, that it's forbidden to give it to him. Take that position, then the rule would violate procedural due process. It would not ensure that a pro se defendant had notice of the basis for the competency finding, and would not give the pro se defendant a reasonable opportunity to respond to the competency report. So we'd ask this court to reject that argument that the state's made regarding the notice issue.
On the notice issue, did I think the district court concluded that there wasn't, that Mr. Walford hadn't established prejudice. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what prejudice was there as reflected in the record at post-conviction?
I mean, for the due process violation, it'd be our position that he doesn't have to show further prejudice beyond not receiving notice and not having an opportunity to respond to the proceeding.
And what case would you cite for the proposition that he doesn't have to show prejudice? You can let us know on
Medina. I mean, Medina versus California held that defendants have a procedural due process rights in competency proceedings, and it didn't have a prejudice prong attached to that due process analysis. It's rather a question of whether the procedures met the baseline requirements of a procedural due process. So at least for the constitutional claim, the case law suggested that there's no additional prejudice requirement beyond that. And proceedings were suspended. Our argument is that based on the due process violations, those competency orders were not valid. So, you know, at the time of his plea, there was no valid competency order in place. So his guilty plea, therefore, was invalid because it was not based on a valid competency order. But I can address these arguments more during rebuttal. Sorry, same amount of time.
Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. Counsel for respondent, please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Alexandra Meyer, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this matter. Mr. Walford's history before this court includes the reversal of three separate convictions based on the same types of behaviors he exhibited during this case, by discharging counsel and then claiming he was forced to proceed without counsel, by refusing to accept documents from counsel, then claiming no one provided him discovery, by disrupting proceedings and yelling profanities at the court, refusing to leave his cell to go to court, and finally, by entering a plea with the full intention of withdrawing it or seeking to invalidate it on appeal. Mr. Walford's plea was not unintentional. It was blatantly manipulative.
What do you base that? I mean, is this a botched Rule 26.01 plea agreement? What is it? What is the state's position on what kind of plea this was?
So if you look at Mr. Walford's understanding of what an appeal is, he at no time understood what an appeal actually is. And at the evidentiary hearing, he told the court he had already appealed his case, that he was there in the post-conviction hearing because of his appeal. He believed he appealed this case. And the record, if you look at all of the transcripts in this case, from dozens of these records, anytime the court told Mr. Walford something, he would not agree, he would reject it, he would tell the court, no, that's not true, despite the court telling him valid law. And this is not the only case that Mr. Walford has done that in. He has had five separate appeals. This court has reversed on three separate occasions because of the way he refuses to follow the procedures of the court and then says, you have backed me into a corner.
But let's just in this case, what does the state contend is the plea? Because honestly, I'm not clear on it. I mean, is it a Lothenbach? Is it, you know, without being stipulated facts because it's an, you know, it's an Alford plea? But otherwise, this, what is it? What's the state's position?
I believe that the parties in the courtroom all agreed that it was an Alford plea with the agreement that he could still appeal, which doesn't seem possible.
Pre-trial rulings?
I imagine.
And you can still appeal, but the question is the pre-trial, right?
Well, and he said he wanted to appeal, and he said, I want an Alford plea, and I want to appeal, and everyone said, fine. Because he had no, these weren't appellate issues. These were his personal disagreements with various things the court had done. And after watching him do this for 4 years, the court wanted to give him what he wanted. They wanted to allow him to conclude his case and go serve his concurrent prison term. And he was never going to say, yes, I will enter an Alford plea if you don't, or rather, he was always going to say, I'm going to appeal this. Let me do what I want, or I'm going to appeal. And they said, fine, you can appeal.
You're referenced all the other cases. I mean, did the post-conviction court rely or refer to that history?
Yes, it did.
And where do I find that? In the, I mean, I feel like you're giving us facts and considerations that are kind of extraneous to the issue.
So
here.
It was certainly in our briefing. We cited all of the cases in our briefing to this court.
I know,
and
but
in
did the post? I mean, you say he was blatantly manipulative. I don't remember the post-conviction court saying that as a reason to deny his petition.
So let me find it. So he didn't use those exact words, but the court specifically said, and I highlighted it. He refused to accept. This is on Respondent's Addendum, page 33. Showing him cursing at the court, talking over the judge without answering questions, refusing transport, refusing to accept documents from advisory council, refusing to speak to advisory council, and then saying he was forced to be his own attorney and he only cared about preserving the matter for appeal. If you look at a transcript that the district court cited from February of 2018 in front of Judge Gruing,
okay, but how does that factor into the legal analysis? I mean, I guess...
In looking at the analysis of whether the guilty plea was unintelligent in the district court's order, I don't see any mention of it being manipulative, that he understood the rights he was giving up and that he understood he couldn't appeal non-jurisdictional issues.
I would agree that...
The analysis... So the argument you're making here, I don't think was how the district court analyzed the post-conviction court analyzed the issue.
Well, the post-conviction court did say that he was making this decision in the interest of judicial economy. And I would argue that that holistic view...
Isn't an Alford plea usually made in the interest of not wanting to go to trial?
Well, Mr. Walford always said he wanted to go to trial, and then he tried to go to trial, and he couldn't get through the trial without arguing with the judge. He couldn't, they started trial, and the judge raised the competency issue because he could not communicate with Mr. Walford sufficiently to proceed through the trial. And I think that is part of the...
So what do we do? I mean, directing this back to this case, because I think my colleagues are correct that we don't have all these other cases in this record. And we can just make a decision based on what happened in this case. So we've got this plea where the state, you know, said, yeah, you can appeal. The judge accepted that, pretrial issues.
Yes.
But that's not the law unless it actually comes under. So is this a 21.06? Is it not? Is it an imperfect? I mean, what is it? And then should we be looking at the merits of the issues he wanted to raise? Is that at all relevant?
So it would be an imperfect.
Or is that within our purview to look at, or is that something the district court would need to look at? I don't know.
I believe you can view it as an imperfect 2601.
defendant, sorry, 2601. I think I reversed the numbers.
Defendant.
Yeah, yeah.
Mr. Walford definitely thought that that's what he was doing. He's using the word Lothenbach.
Where in the transcript do you find that? Because when I look at the transcript, I see the exact opposite. I see a discussion about advisory counsel, Mr. Walford saying, in the transcript, advisory counsel saying one thing you wanted to reserve your ability to appeal decisions or things that happened before today. Is that correct? Correct. And then advisory counsel says, and I told you that both the judge and Ms. Lammon from the state that it's neither of their intentions to prohibit that. Is that correct? Yes, ma'am, Walford says. Then advisory counsel. And you talked to me about what is called an Alford plea, is that right? A Lothenbach plea, is that right? Yes. And I told you in this particular case that wasn't the appropriate kind of thing because there wasn't one particular what I call dispositive issue, is that right? Yes, ma'am. And I explained to you what dispositive meant, yes, ma'am. And you agree with me that based on that, the Lothenbach wasn't the way to go, is that right? Yes, ma'am. And there's no mention of Rule 26.01, that this plea was pursuant to that. It was always referred to as, the pleas were referred to as Alford pleas. So I don't see where in the transcript you're getting your reading of this as being something other than an Alford plea or Alford pleas.
So I am getting it from the evidentiary hearing transcript in which he refused to accept that an Alford plea and a Lothenbach plea were what they actually are. He told the post-conviction court that he wanted an Alford plea because he knew that that's how you got an appeal, despite,
didn't counsel at the, plea hearing have, or the district court have a duty to clarify to Mr. Walford at the time as to what his, that he didn't have the right to appeal non-jurisdictional pretrial issues if he entered Alford pleas?
I would agree that this is an incredibly messy situation, and the district court probably should have dealt with it differently. The reason I have referred to all of these other cases that Mr. Walford has is in the district court at this level, with so many cases going on, the judge knew who this defendant was and how difficult it was to get through any single proceeding with him. So the judge is essentially saying, we've made it here. You know what you want. You're saying what you want. I have no reason to tell you you don't get what you want. Because if he had said no, we're in year four of this case. And there was no end in sight unless the judge said, fine, you can enter an Alford plea and you can appeal whatever you want. Nobody's going to stop you. We're not going to stop you. Because if the court had said you can't do that, what would the result have been? We would more arguments that never ended because Mr. Walford would not respond to the court in a way that he needed to, and he would not listen to advisory counsel who would tell him what he needed to do. It's an incredibly frustrating record when you look at, if you look at all the transcripts in this case over and over again, he just disagrees with the district court about basic facts about what's going on. So that is why I point the court to the other cases that it's dealt with, because the history underlying this defendant's appearance in district court in Ramsey County was extensive, and everyone there knew it. I believe the prosecutor was the prosecutor on all the cases in Ramsey County and was very familiar with how these cases had proceeded. I would refer the court to Heron, the unpublished or the non-precedential case that counsel cited. And I would note that in that case, this court put in a footnote saying that it wouldn't address the issues under plain error because the state hadn't raised it or argued it. If that's not a...
Can you point us to any case where plain error has been applied to evaluate the constitutionality of a guilty plea? I mean, you cite us to the Mira case.
I believe
Hopefully
Myrie.
I'm pronouncing that correctly. But
I've been saying Myrie. But
Myrie, excuse me.
Myrie is definitely the closest thing we can come to this. And if you look at the procedural history of that case, it involved the same type of arguably misadvice.
But in Myrie, they discussed Lothenbach.
And they discussed Lothenbach.
And there were stipulated facts or stipulated evidence. And that wasn't the case here.
Well, there was evidence that was put into the record.
But it wasn't stipulated to.
I would agree with that.
So I don't know. I see a number of differences. I understand your point about this, you know, being a messy record, but what is your best argument that this really was a Rule 26, an attempt at a Rule 26 plea?
My best argument would be that looking at the transcript in particular, the portion where advisory counsel says you wanted me to present a counteroffer to the state because you wanted to have an appeal, that to me, what Mr. Walford wanted was essentially a stipulated facts trial where he got to appeal anything he wanted to. And the court and counsel said, that's fine. And then after he did that, believing that he could do that, he did not appeal. If he had filed an appeal within the 90 days of the decision or of his sentence, then this court could have decided and this court could have reversed at that point. But he didn't. He waited 2 years and then he filed a motion to withdraw his plea and had an evidentiary hearing where he said, I always was going to withdraw this plea. That's the part of this that is manipulative, that going into this plea, he was going to say whatever it took to get through that court date and go back to prison where he wanted to serve his concurrent sentence. And allowing him yet again to go into the plea saying, I entered that plea knowing that I was always going to withdraw it. That's disingenuous, that's manipulative. And that would
and
be.
Where is that? That's in the.
In the transcript of the evidentiary hearing.
Evidentiary hearing.
Specifically around pages 22 and through 24.
So did the district court have the authority, going back to the plea hearing, to say, yes, you can go ahead and appeal any pretrial issues? That's my understanding of the deal. That's fine. I mean, that's basically what the state and the district court judge said.
Yes.
So did the district court have the authority to say that, or is that a misstatement of the law? And then I guess that's my question.
May I briefly answer? I'm out of time.
Yes, you may.
So I would go back to what Judge Johnson had said. We don't know what would have happened.
Right.
So the exhaustion, probably he could have appealed. He certainly could have filed his paperwork and then we would know what would have happened, but he didn't do that.
So we have to decide whether this is a 2601, you know, kind of a muffed up attempt to reach a stipulated facts under pursuant to 2601 or
I
not.
Think you could look to the guidance in Myrie of the Supreme Court about the intentions of the party, the holistic view of what the parties were trying to accomplish and say what everyone agreed they were trying to accomplish here was to allow him to plead guilty and then to file an appeal about whatever non-dispositive issues he wanted. And having done that and then not appealed, you should look at it under plain error and find no prejudice.
To your point about his, To your point about his failure to file a notice of appeal, is there any case law that supports your argument that that is relevant to our analysis, or that curtails his claim, or should require us to affirm?
I think only just the general prejudice analysis. I don't know of any specific case. Honestly, there's never been something this messy happening that you've had to deal with before. So luckily there isn't case law specifically that would address that.
Judge Cochran has a question.
In terms of the transcript from the post-conviction hearing and his understanding about filing an appeal, isn't one way to read the transcript that he thought the post-conviction filing was his appeal? I mean, he keeps saying that that's why we're here today.
But
so, I mean, you know, I guess that's my question for you.
Well, he also says, I did appeal this. I appealed it 120 days after,
right,
at the latest.
And then he says, he says, I filed that application and they didn't give me an attorney until about a year after, and that... and then he says he's now represented by Mr. McLaughlin, and I don't know. It's not clear to me that he really fully understands the appeal process.
Nor does he want to, would be my counter. But counsel specifically asked him about whether I've lost my train of thought.
Filed an appeal?
Yes. Counsel specifically asked him whether anyone had told him that he couldn't file an appeal, and he said no. So he believed after his sentencing that he could file an appeal. Nobody told him he couldn't. He did not. That would be the overall view of what everyone wanted to accomplish, and he then waived his appellate right through that and not through anything the district court did. I thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Mr. McLaughlin, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. I just want to begin sort of with the state's argument that because this was a messy record, because Mr. Walford's case had been open for a long time, and because, frankly, he struggled with both mental health and personality issues that made things more difficult, that could justify misadvising him somehow that he could appeal, or that justified the court's action and everybody saying, no, you can appeal this, just sort of in the interest of getting it wrapped up. And we would just totally reject that argument. The Constitution applies to easy defendants and difficult defendants alike. It creates the same intelligence requirements, whether a defendant is pleasant with the court or difficult. So that's no justification for what the court did. And, you know, there's also nothing in this record to suggest this was a Rule 2601 proceeding. As we said, he was repeatedly told it was an Alford plea. He entered a guilty plea under Alford. He was told specifically by advisory counsel this was not a Loefenbach plea. The court never made a finding of guilt, which is required for any court trial under Rule 2601. It was a plea.
Alford,
it was a guilty plea.
Sort of a... I mean, it's not an actual guilty plea, but, is this where we're looking at form over substance? Because the name Loefenbach is in the advisory council's question, at least, and then there's this agreement among everybody, yes, you can appeal pretrial rulings. Why should we say, oh, but it's not on the right forms, which the Supreme Court has said, oh, we're really supposed to look to substance over form. How do we deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, every time the Supreme Court said look to substance over form, it's been to protect a defendant's right to appeal. It's been to protect a defendant's constitutional rights. Here the state's asking this court to look to substance to deprive Mr. Walford of his right to appeal, to find a plea intelligent where otherwise it would be unintelligent. So I think it's a very different ask that the state's making about applying substance over form. And in substance, even if we look just kind of past the form, in substance, this was a guilty plea. This was an Alford plea. There's nothing in the substance to suggest this was a Loefenbach. Again, advisory counsel specifically said it was not a Loefenbach. There's nothing in the substance to suggest it was a Rule 2601. The court never said anything about 2601, never said anything about stipulated evidence, never said anything about stipulated facts. What it did say something about repeatedly was that this was an Alford plea. So I think in both substance and form, it was an Alford plea, and that's how this court should review it.
What about respondent's argument that Mr. Walford's testimony at the post-conviction hearing suggests that it was intended to be a Rule 26.01 plea?
When I read that testimony, all it shows to me is that Mr. Walford remained confused about his appellate rights following a guilty plea. And that confusion began when he was told by advisory counsel at the time of the plea, and when the court and the prosecutor reinforced that he would retain the right to appeal after his guilty plea. So I think that's what's reflected in his post-conviction testimony. There's nothing in the post-conviction testimony that he was manipulating things. All he said was that he intended to appeal after his guilty plea. There's nothing in there to suggest that he was, you know, that he strategically pleaded guilty just to, make things difficult for the system. All he says is that he pleaded guilty and he intended to file an appeal on that guilty plea. And again, that understanding was based on the misrepresentations that were made to him at the time of his plea, that he could still appeal these pretrial issues that were important to him after he entered his Alford pleas. So I don't think there's anything in the plea record that supports the state's claim that this was a manipulation and that he was playing games with the system. So I think this is really a straightforward case. To be intelligent, you've got to know the consequences of your plea. Mr. Walford was misadvised about his right to appeal. Plain error is irrelevant. All the issues the state raises about the fact that he didn't file an appeal are irrelevant. All this court needs to look at is the plea record, and that's all that intelligence analysis is based on, is that plea record. And that plea record shows he was misadvised, that he entered an Alford plea based on misinformation. And based on that, we'd ask the court to reverse the conviction.
Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days.